Hi, I'm Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. Sober through the grace of God and AA since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. I want to thank Bob for the opportunity of being here, and it is a privilege to be amongst the other presenters that I am. This is nice. There's a nice feeling in the room, and I think everybody's kind of plugged in. As a preliminary, in some ways we're being asked to do something that I don't think you can do, which is, you know, tell me how you did 5, 6, and 7. AA is changing a little bit. We probably have more teaching around AA than we've ever had since I've been around. You know, we do have more big book studies. You go out there and we have tapes on lots of people doing the 12 steps. And we've always been an oral society, and which is better than being an anal society. But maybe we've been both. But every organization made of human beings has a tendency to move towards orthodoxy. And over the last number of years, I've seen a tendency in our fellowship to move to orthodoxy. And I don't know that there's anything particularly wrong with that, because we are devoted to our big book, and our big book is our text. But part of what goes along with orthodoxy is you start to get the feeling, something that I never used to hear much in AA, is that this is right, and if you're not doing it this way, you're really not quite as good at AA as the person who is doing it that way. That's not a spiritual communication. And there's a tendency when we talk about wanting to be right, you know, that's kind of the booby prize. The steps are spiritual in nature. They are not mechanical. If they were mechanical, every time we had a problem, all we'd have to do is click our heels and say the third step prayer, and we'd be back in Kansas. For those of us that have been around for a while, sometimes when you click your heels and say the third step prayer, you don't always get the relief or the change that you'd like to get. So, and I don't in any way want to, I don't want to be on the other side of you know, our book, for goodness sakes, that's our text. But I think we got to be careful about how we share some of the stuff we do. I mean, a lot of us used to react to how people would beat you up with the Bible. You know, how people would take certain things as, you know, this is the answer, it's right here, it's in black and white. And I hope we don't ever get to the point where we beat each other with our book. It's an extraordinary thing. I'm a little nervous. And isn't it an interesting thing? I'm nervous about giving this presentation. I've been sober 39 years. It's come Sunday if I stay sober. And I've gone through the steps many times, and what's got me nervous is my ego. So I'm going to do my very best to ignore that. But because the steps are spiritual exercises, spiritual principles, and because our book... Our book, in a way, is our menu. And you can starve to death eating the menu. The book is what brings you someplace. By doing what the book says, you have an experience. Okay? It isn't quite as simple, I don't think, as you know, it's the instructions like boiling water. You know, I always think, Sandy, if there was a, you know, if I got a book on how to fly a jet airplane, and it was 500 pages long, and I read that book 50 times... and talk to Sandy and talk to a half a dozen or maybe a dozen jet plane pilots, which was Sandy was, and heard stories about all the experiences they've had and knew every word in that book, I have an idea that if I walked up to a jet plane and put a key in the damn thing, if there is such a key, and turned the engine on, I'd have a little trouble flying it. And our book is about living life. And life is fired at you at point-blank range. There isn't absolute preparation. You know, that's why it's so demanding. I mean, if it was as simple as understanding the words in 164 pages, none of us would have the issues that we are in this room having. So I'm going to talk mostly about change. 5, 6, and 7, I think, are really about change. It's what my sponsor kind of told us. There isn't anybody in this room that has that down perfectly. You can't own the territory. It is not, you know, we don't have any experts. We don't have any Tiger Woods. you know, who can do it better than anybody. We have people who do it well. We have people who are good player coaches, and they put the principles in action in their life. But the measure of what it is to be a good AA is still what you do in your life. And you live your life in relationships. And those of us that are married know that marriage is not always a perfectly even keel. And those of us that have children and have tried to raise kids, we know that you're not always in control in that process. Relationships are pretty pithy arenas to live life in. And so all of us are a little bit like fish out of water when we take these principles and go to apply them, because it's a, I don't know, it's just a demanding process. So I just wanted to kind of share that as a kind of a introduction to what I'm about to say. The fifth step, you know, admitted to God, to ourselves, another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs, is probably one of the great rites of passage in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think most of us, once we've done a fourth and fifth step, feel like we're more a real member of AA than we ever have, you know, have been. And time and time again this weekend, you've heard people talk about having walls built around them, how we feel separate, how we feel different, how we don't feel part of, that we've had those feelings before we even started to drink, and even while we drank, drinking was the only thing that kind of diluted that and made us feel part of. And that's part of the reason we shared that. We probably come in with the most profound sense of uniqueness that you could come in anywhere. And if you don't lose some of that sense of uniqueness, you will not stay, because you will look for the differences rather than the similarities. That's got to be reduced in some manner, shape, or form, or you just won't identify. You just won't let go enough. So I built a wall around me. The wall, you know, all of us have that kind of wall. And the thinking that went on behind the wall said this. It said, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything about me, you'd hate me, because I hate me, and who knows more what a lousy, crummy, insufficient person I am than me. I'm walking around comparing my inside with your outside. When we come into AA, maybe it started for me, the first time I started to crumble that wall and take it down was maybe when I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And then when I got my sponsor and I started to have conversations with him, little by little I started to chip away at that wall. And when I took my fifth step, when I took my fourth step, and I started to get into some conversations with my sponsor, and then when I took my fifth step, the wall came all the way down. And for the first time in my life, I shared the whole deck of cards with someone. I had never done that before. And I would kill you with the piece you didn't have. You know, you'd come to me and you'd say, Bob, this is what's wrong. This is what I think you should do. And in my mind, I say, well, that you think I should do that because of what you know, but there's a heck of a lot about me you don't know. There's items about me that no one knows. I'm not going to tell you. So I could neutralize whatever you said to me because you didn't know that. But when I tore the whole wall down and I shared the whole deck of cards in my fist up, I made a discovery. The discovery was that I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, not my feelings, not my experience. And for the first time in my life, I started to have a sense of hope that would work for you, would work for me. And I'm a guy that always had trouble. It seemed like what worked for other people didn't work for me. I came from a nice family and kind of screwed up my life. I went to a nice school and kind of screwed up it. I was the only one of my high school. 12 of us went to this college, and I was the only one of the 12 who didn't finish, kind of the story of my life. And isn't that kind of all our stories? You know, we can do this spectacular. We can fly airplanes. We just have trouble keeping jobs, balancing checkbooks, staying married, you know, raising children, earning a living. You know, we have trouble with taking life on in life's terms. And yet, as talent goes, none of us seem to be under-equipped in the business of, you know, that. But we have I thought I had a built-in failure mechanism. When I came to AA, what I expected and hoped to find was someone who was so smart and had so much insight that he could look right through me and see my soul and tell me what was really going on. And I never found that. What happened to me is I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I surrendered. And when I surrendered, Bob became a lot less important, and what became important to me is I was an alcoholic. And when being an alcoholic was the most important thing, all of a sudden I had 100 people around me who could teach me. They knew a heck of a lot more about alcoholism and a heck of a lot more about recovery of alcoholism than I did. So probably for the first 8 or 9 months in AA, I'd ask a question, someone would give me an answer. I had an answer. In about 8 or 9 months, my ego started to return, and I wasn't so sure that I had an answer. But in the process, when we get into the process, and I want to reiterate that we're assuming when you're taking step five that you've done one through four. When well, I say that especially for people who've been around for a while. One of the things I see in our area, 95% of our meetings are closed-step discussion meetings in Minnesota, where, you know, we really work a lot on what we try to focus on the solution. I see a heck of a lot of people who are in trouble who go, you know, they go do an inventory, and they assume that they've got steps one, two, and three active and available to them. And I think a lot, you know, how we always talked about, if you're having trouble with step four, go to step three. If you're having trouble with step three, go to step two. I think a lot of us that are in later recovery don't have steps one through three current. And we kind of, it's a fascinating thing that in Alcoholics Anonymous, after you get a certain amount of sobriety, you can start to use your sobriety as an excuse not to work the program. Because you've got enough prima facie evidence that what you do works. You know, so if you've got 15 or 20 years of sobriety, I mean, you've got the right arm patch on. You know, so, I mean, if anybody, you know, really gets in your face, you know, you're, you know, kind of a veteran journeyman in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, you can start telling people how you did it, and you can talk about your 25 years of sobriety, and I don't want to diss anybody's amount of sobriety. I think it's important. But we use that on ourselves to exempt ourselves from doing some of the work that we felt we automatically had to do when we were earlier in our sobriety. We let ourselves get by with crap that we wouldn't let sponsees get by. Not in Nevada, but we do, you know. I know that you do. And many of you in the audience have heard my talk. I came in AA when I was 23 years old. I had my last drink a week after my 24th birthday. I drank a lot for a young guy. My drinking experience isn't long. It isn't as dramatic as some people's, but it was enough to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I almost killed myself a number of different times. I came in AA. I found a man who's still my sponsor today. His name is Warren M., and he's got 52 years of sobriety, and he's 87 years old, and he was the most active member of AA in the group that I had the privilege to attend. He sat me down in a chair and said, "Bob, alcoholism, you know," he first told me, somewhat similarly to what Clancy said, he said, "Alcohol is not your problem. Well, your problem is alcoholism, and it's quite different. If alcohol was your problem, stopping drinking would solve your problem. Have you ever stopped drinking?" "Yes." "Did it work?" "No." He said, "It didn't work for any of us." He said, "What we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, once we take our last drink or drug, is we take the 12 steps and apply them in our lives to find a different way to live that's sufficiently better than the way we lived before. Alcoholism is physical, but it's also mental and spiritual. Once you cross the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, your alcoholism affects you all the time, when you are drinking and when you are not drinking." That was a new piece of information for me. The idea that my alcoholism could affect me when I was not drinking was a brand new idea. I came in and I was, you know, I went to a meeting every day. The gift for me is I liked AA. I work with a lot of young people, and I had trouble getting them to go to meetings. That was not my issue. The gift, I liked it. It's been hard for me to do the work, but it's never been hard for me to stay in AA. So for my first 8 or 9 months when I had my wall down and I was surrendered, it was one of the most magical periods I had, even though the circumstances of my life were difficult. Then when my ego started to reassert itself, I started to become aware. When I did a four-step when I was about 2.5 months sober, and a fifth step. And my first fifth step, I did in the form of a general confession. I'm a Catholic and kind of did what the book said. I read the 12 and 12 and I read the big book, but I mostly, it's interesting. I love Scott's presentation today. My wife leaned over to me in the middle of your presentation and said, "Do not compare yourself with him." It's fascinating that she knows me that well. I am, to let you know that I'm a real alcoholic, I was spending about 20% of the time comparing myself to Scott. It's intimidating when you're into people who are that familiar with the book. It's intimidating when you see someone take a good mind and a good ability to communicate and dissect our four-step with that type of clarity. I have never taken a four-step with the level of clarity which we presented it with this morning. I've done 15 or 20 of them in my almost 39 years. And that's the part of us. Why should I be neurotic? You can only do what you can do. You do your best with the steps. You know, it isn't like I didn't try. And when you run into people, and if you took everybody in this room, only a certain portion of the people in this room could go through the process he described. I think it would take, you know, I don't know if it would take a certain personality, whatever it is. And please don't hear in any way that I'm in any way being critical of the process you go through. I'm an admirer of what I heard this morning. But my sponsor was a mailman. And he was the king of the 12-steppers. And he took me through the fourth and fifth step, but mostly it was, here's what I want. You know, I did the first three steps, the same thing as who was Charlie was talking today. And he told me that basically he felt like I had done the first three steps because I was going to meetings and doing all the things that I, you know, had done. And he kind of, you know, took me, he said, I think you can do the first three steps sitting on your seat. And then he sent me home and I started to do the fourth step. And then when I had a little trouble, I'd come back and I'd talk to him about it. And then I did the fifth step. And I had a pretty good response with my fifth step. But I didn't have much insight with my fourth step, because I didn't go through it with the level of detail that you described. What I did is I got rid of most of the things that I thought made me a moral leper and the things that I was afraid to tell anybody. And I had a pretty profound sense of forgiveness, and I had a pretty good sense that I was involved in a program that could help remove some of the problems that were in my life. Those were the two dominant feelings I got when I walked out of that priest's office on the way back. And I started to make some progress in my life in areas that I had not done. But what happened to me over a period of time is, as I started to go to meetings and as I continued to take the steps, it wasn't until my second year that I really had started to have a list of the defects of character that I had. I did not have much insight into the causes and conditions of my alcoholism. Now, my experience with my alcoholism, the physical part went away. But the mental and spiritual part is why I still go to meetings of alcohol. It isn't alcoholism, it's alcoholism. I'm still dealing with the mental and emotional and spiritual aspects of my disease daily. So during the next 4 or 5 years, not only did I get a better list of what my defects of character was, I started to get some insight into the causes and conditions of my alcoholism. In addition to that, I identified about 6 or 7 behaviors that were just killing me. Work. I had trouble getting up to go to work. I had trouble getting up, which I found out had to do with when I went to bed. I didn't know that for quite a while. But I had trouble getting to work. I had a little trouble staying at work, and I had some trouble working at work. Other than that, I was a good worker. I had that problem for 7 years. Now, you think a guy who was fairly smart, who took the steps, who did that, wouldn't have that problem for 7 years. I had it for 7 years. I had a gambling problem. Yeah, I know that's not much of an issue out in this area, but it was. We had some problems in Minnesota. And it was more of a hobby, 6 or 7 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. But I was making 8 or 9 grand a year playing backgammon, and it seemed like a second job. I spent more money than I made. I had children that I was sometimes violent with. I was loud, impatient, angry, and sometimes violent with my kids. And that was my life. And I had all those defects of character and did not do enough of a detailed inventory when I did my first one to notice it. But as I did my second one, and especially when I did my third one at 7 years, I was so familiar with my defects of character, I was thinking about ending my life. I'm a great starter, but I'm a poor finisher. And I found myself increasingly, as I started to go through AA, that I was having problems that I didn't think I should have. And it almost killed me, you know, because I felt like it was my pattern to be a good starter, and then I just start to run into issues, and then I never make it, you know, through the bend. The wall that I tore down on my first fifth step, and when we look in the book, In the 12 and 12, we look in the, you know, it starts to talk about that sense of isolation is going to go away. You're going to have a sense that you can be forgiven. You're going to have a sense that you can forgive others. You know, your first kind of really true, profound influence of humility is going to start to happen with you. And, you know, those things happened to me. But as I started to go through and still have problems in sobriety, I started to build the damn wall back up. And I look back on that. That's extraordinary. Charlie, you know, so brick by brick, I built my wall back up sober, going to 5 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week. Thank you very much for helping my drinking problem. Stay out of my sex life. Brick. Thank you very much for helping my drinking problem. Stay out of my finances. Stay out of my marriage. Stay out of my parenting. Stay out of my job. Stay out of my gambling. Brick by brick, sober, and I didn't do it intentionally. I was telling my sponsor 65 or 70% of what was going on. And I know you guys do 100. I want to know. I know you do it. I really think that's, you're to be congratulated. The fact was I was only telling myself 65% of what was going on. You don't see it when you're going through it. You can see it, you know, life's lived forward, but you understand it backwards. So I could look back and start to see my patterns, and I could look back and see what didn't work. But I had, I was trying as hard as I knew how, but I didn't seem to be making the progress. I felt like I was going backwards more than I was going forwards. My pigeons were making more progress at that stage in my sobriety than I was. Which, again, is, you know, we make extraordinary progress in the first year or two of our sobriety. We come in here with problems that are just huge, and we have the surrender experience. We get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we clear away a lot of big stuff in a relatively short period of time. But I think you can't get it all done in the first couple of years. And you can't have all the insights that you're supposed to have in the first couple of years. And I found myself with 6 and 7 years of sobriety with my nose pressed into a pretty good-sized pile of cow manure. And I was pretty upset with myself and not feeling very good about my AA program. I thought, my God, if I had to go to another program for every problem I had, you know, Spenders Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Anger Anonymous, I'd be a pretty busy guy. And then, you know, I'm an idealist, so I have the same problem that Bill talks about in the 12 and 12, is if God gives us the grace in Alcoholics Anonymous to be perfectly relieved of our physical part of our alcoholism, why wouldn't you expect, if we had that big a change by going through the steps, that we couldn't have the change with the other the living problems that we have in our life? And Bill goes on to say that he felt that the reason for that was, the reason that he got that kind of relief was his surrender, that he was beaten up so badly by the disease of alcoholism that at that point in time he was open. Clancy, who wonderfully did step 1, 2, and 3, when I hear Clancy talk, I get a sense he didn't surrender, he was surrendered. I mean, he was broken. The disease was so profound that it got him in a state of reasonableness where when he talks about, I started to do things that other people wouldn't do. I think I had a surrender when I first came in, but I had to find another surrender. I started to take it back. And I think that's, you know, over and over, Bill talks about how these steps are a lifelong process. It's interesting the differences in the 12 and 12. You know, most of us, an awful lot of the conservative members in the program think the only text that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is the big book. They think God wrote the big book. And you think that Bill wrote the 12 and 12 in his office. And they don't hold as much stock. I find the 12 and 12 very interesting to me and enormously helpful. I think Bill, with 7 or 8 years of sobriety, started to experience the frustration. You know, he was an idealist. You know, he wasn't experiencing the perfection in his life. He struggled with, you know, deep depression all the way through, almost all the way up and through the time that he wrote the 12 and 12. And so we see a different, you know, where we have 2 paragraphs in the big book on 6 and 7, you know, we've got, you know, 2 pretty significant chapters in the big, in the 12 and 12, and how we talk about the only way to take a fourth step is, you know, with the columns. Well, he doesn't use the columns when he's in the 12 and 12. He starts to talk about, you know, the problems that we have with instincts. So most of us, I think, come in to sobriety, and in our early and middle sobriety, we start to expect that if we put these principles in action in our lives are going to get okay. I had that. That was, you know what I thought sobriety, what I thought recovery was? I thought recovery was the absence of problems. Now, I made that up, but literally, that's what I started, you know, I had this idea of perfection that if I really got my act together, and I so admired certain people in AA that I almost didn't see their problems, you know, which is nuts. I'm over at my sponsor's house. I see how he gets, you know, I mean, he and his wife would occasionally snipe at each other, and, you know, I knew him as a human being, not as a, you know, not as anything else, but I just overlooked his problems. It was my problems that I was more focused on. So I think this problem of not being able to perfectly, you know, to have the type of change and have the change of depth that many of us want is one of the most, Bill calls it a riddle. He thinks it's, you know, was the major riddle in our recovery. Pretend for a moment that I'm working with a guy who's having trouble with doing a four-step with the Collins. And he's 40 years old, married with children. And I'm going to tell this guy, look, I know you're having a problem with the book. It gets a little complicated with all the columns. Don't worry about that. Get your wife and your mom and dad and your sister and your brother and your boss and your kids and a couple of guys from your group and bring them over to the house. And here's what I want you to say to them. I want you to say that we have a step in Alcoholics Anonymous where we try to get in touch with our defects of character, and I'm having trouble identifying mine. And I was wondering if you'd help. And then hand out tablets and paper and leave the room. You'd have a hell of a start on an inventory. But most of us wouldn't call that meeting. Because we're afraid. We don't want, you know, a lot of the things that we're dealing with, we don't want to change. But it's even worse than that. We don't want to know. We start to train the other people in our lives as to what they can talk about and what they can't talk about. You know, you look at your wife and you say, you want to have that conversation? It's going to be a tough conversation. Nod your head up and down if you understand that. You get into that arena with me and it's going to be a tough conversation. You train your kids as to what they can say and can't say to you. You train your boss and co-workers into what they can say and can't say to you. People get the message as to what we're really be willing to be in front of and what we're willing not to be in front of. And it is a program of change. But I think many of us are so afraid of change. We so identify with some of the behaviors that are in our lives, we think they're who we are, not what we do. We have collapsed that distinction. And I would hope that we would get that back. It isn't, our behavior is not who we are, it is what we do. It is indicative of our character. And it is indicative that there are problems. But if we're supposed to find out what doesn't work in our lives, how the heck are we supposed to find it out? You're going to find it out through your wife. You're going to find it out through your boss. You're going to find it out through your kids. You're going to find it out through your sponsor. You're going to find it out through people in the group. And yet many of us put up barriers so that we do not get that input. You know, look, I'll make you a deal. I won't call you on your crap. You don't call me on mine. You know, we'll go out and we'll talk about the steps and the traditions. You stay out of my face, I'll stay out of yours. Deal? Bad deal. Not a good deal. When I came in AA during my first 4 or 5 years, I tried like heck to change some of those lists of defects of character that I told you about the gambling and work and spending money and parenting and marriage and stuff. And I prayed pretty hard on them, and I didn't make much progress. I tried and I failed, I tried and I failed, I tried and I failed, but it still grew. But there comes a time, in my experience, where you either have to change or you stop growing. Which is a pretty dangerous thing for those of us that are in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I think it's a kind of a continuous program of change and of growth. And when you dig your heels in, or when I dig my heels in and say, this I can't do, I've tried, I'm not going to do it. What you do is you start to build an addition onto your house to accommodate the problem. Because it's not going away. And you start training the people in your life that you're not open to having that discussed or change. And you start hanging out with people who are comfortable with that as to how it is. And we plateau. Which is another very dangerous thing. I think when I found myself plateauing at about 6 years of sobriety, and I had built my wall back up, so I'm sitting in meetings 5 and 6 days a week, you know, feeling like I'm kind of lame, feeling like I'm not making much progress, feeling like I'm... I don't know why that is. Why do we expect ourselves to be problem-free? And why, when we discover a problem, do we feel worse about ourselves? Rather than better, that at least when looking, that we identified a defect of character which we can now look on. But we don't. We start to, you know, as soon as we identify something that isn't right, we feel badly that we've identified the damn thing. Which is exactly the opposite of how we generally would hope we would be in our program. One of Clancy's sayings that I like the best is that there's no pain in change. There's only pain in resistance to change. And everybody in this room has that experience, that most of us were afraid to death about coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, afraid to death to stop drinking. We come in, and the pain that we thought we were going to experience of not drinking was an illusion. When we finally surrendered and broke through that, it was easy. But most of us are, you know, when I take a look at step six, I said we're entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. You know, it'd be really interesting if we had a secret vote that Sandy talked about the other, or whoever talked about that this morning, Scott did. If we had a secret vote, I mean, how many of us really believe today that the problems in our lives that we can change? Because the problems in our lives are not new. The issues that all of us have in this room are not months old. They're not 1 or 2 years old. They're 10 years old. They're 20 years old. They're 40 years old. And we're never going to get rid of all of them. But the book says that we have to, you know, take on the more serious defects of character that we have and commence to work on them in a serious manner. And I think a lot of us, from periodically, I give up on it. That I don't have, you know, that I don't, you know, I just don't have the attitude. My spiritual condition isn't high enough that I'm willing to really take it on, or I don't take it on in a serious enough way. I find myself kind of up and down. And at certain periods, I can take anything on and I do a really good job with it. In other periods, I'm either a little depressed or I just don't pay much attention to it and I kind of slide. I get periods of time where there isn't much growth going on. And sometimes our programs just get a little flat. But the idea that we are supposed to be willing to work towards a perfect goal, and the idea that we don't set that standard ourselves, that somehow within our relationship with God, that we would be open to what we think His standard would be in our lives. Pretty courageous thing to do is to open yourself up to what God would have your life be. I think most of us are scared to death of that. I always was. I thought if I really turned my will and my life over to the care of God, I'd end up in China. Which is not exactly what I want. No, but you wouldn't have any fun. You'd never get laid. You wouldn't make a lot of money. I mean, I really had an idea in my head that if you, you know, of what life would be like if you turned your will in your life, truly turned your will in your life over to the care of God the way it is right now. Take your work issues, take your marriage issues, take your parenting issues. Do we really believe that if we open those up to the power, when the book talks about, you know, when we get to step six, it says that the issues in our lives are now about to be expelled. What a powerful thing to say. When they talk about why someone got drunk again, they said he probably didn't do a house cleaning, to clean his house out, to arrange that God could come, that the grace of God could come in and throw out those problems. So you get a sense, most of us have an expectation that, we're, you know, one of the reasons I think we like these step weekends is we feel like we're going to learn something. And I think we do. But most of us know knowledge is not the issue that we have. It's the lack of power. I mean, most of us, if we passed out a test, could pass a test about what we're supposed to do. Almost every guy that comes over to my house has got a problem, and he sits down with that hour and, you know, hands you that bushel basket full of manure that he's got at the moment. Every once in a while, I say, close your eyes. Quiet down. Pretend I just came over to your house and gave you the hour conversation you just gave me. What would you tell me to do? They always know what to do. They just don't have the power to do it. And that is the issue that I think we run into, those of us that have been in the program for a while, is we've got the answers, but we have difficulty applying them ongoingly in our lives with the same power that we had early in our sobriety. And that's why I say when we go back, when we're taking 5, 6, and 7, we better make darn sure that we still understand to some degree with respect to our emotional and spiritual condition that we still are powerless, that our life is still unmanageable, that we still have to have an ongoing belief that God can restore us to sanity and wholeness, and we have to make a decision. And that's one of the things when someone was talking about how you find new words in the book. For some reason, the last couple of years, the word decision has seemed to me, I never quite understood when they said that the third step was an action step. It didn't seem to me early in my sobriety like it was an action step. But when they talk about making a decision, it seems to me they mean something a heck of a lot more than most of us mean in common lore today when we talk about making a decision. It's a serious thing that you did with another person. You went upstairs, you got down on your knees, you said the prayer, and that was supposed to be a watershed mark, much like the, you know, pretty serious when they talk about it when a new man comes over to your house, if he wants to tell his story or make a decision. You know, pretty big stuff. So it's hard for us, you know, when Bill talks about, I think you can see a little bit of Father Dowling in the sixth and the seventh step when Bill talks about it, that he said that it separates the men from the boys or the girls from the women or the adults from the children, that to be really open to having those things change in our lives takes a hell of a lot of courage. And I think a lot of us, because we've had some of the issues in our lives for so long, we have lost hope that we can effectively deal with those problems right now. And that's the thing that I have to keep reminding myself of. I've got my own list of things that I don't do very well with. And, I can give up. You know, I've got 39 years of sobriety. I can make a pretty good case that I'm doing a pretty good job. I'm self-supporting through my own contributions. I've got some merit badges that I can rely on. But the fact is if I had to freeze my life right now, as grateful as I am for what most of what's in my life today, it's not okay. I want to be 40 pounds lighter. I want to have a better relationship with money. I want to have a better relationship with my kids. I want to be less burdensome. I want a lighter feeling. I want more joy in my life. My life, I'm as grateful as I am, I'm heavier from time to time than I want to be in my life. I want to be lighter in my life. And I think part of the stuff I carry around and part of my judgment of myself is what makes that a little heavier. I can't even read the damn thing. Okay. So it takes, you know, one of the great questions in life is when did you stop growing? It'd be an interesting question to each of us if we asked ourselves that question, because that is what some of us do. We only put people in our lives who are willing or able to put up with what we put out. We are only able to work someplace that will put up with what we put out. And so we start to, you know, build a life around us to accommodate some of the issues and troubles that we have. So for me, the ongoing thing in my life is being able to, you know, keep my program vital, keep it alive, and keep believing, you know, keep doing an inventory, keep having a sense. And what's so powerful in the fifth step is once, you know, Sandy talks about he always likes it better when he hears someone in his group give their AA talk because he feels like they have communicated themselves. Our book talks about we're never going to have the freedom and the type of life we want until we have done that with another person and have that person do it with us. You know, that when you give a fifth step and receive a fifth step, that you will start to have a sense, you know, that the sense of isolation, the sense of not having a contact, the sense of non-forgiveness will start to disappear and we will start to have a sense of belonging. The book says that I used to have spiritual beliefs, but now I'm starting to have a spiritual experience. And our goal in AA is to deepen that experience and improve our consciousness so that we can live better in the world. The seventh step has been one, especially in the 12 and 12, which has grown on me a lot in the last maybe 2 years. And the theme of the seventh step, when he talks about it, is almost entirely about humility. And he defines humility in step six. He says that humility is a sense of clearly seeing who and what we are, and with the willingness to become what we can become. I'm not quoting that exactly, but that's fairly close to what the book talks about. And he and over again, Bill talks about that, you know, if you only have the amount of humility that allowed you to get sober, that's not enough for a happy life. It's not enough for a well-balanced life. You have to have more humility because it is the bedrock on which we have, on which we build our program. I think my biggest issue with change, which is what I want to have happen in three or four areas of my life, is that I keep forgetting how change happens. I think, you know, how change happens in our program is generally a little bit more passive than we think it is. I think the majority of us, you know, when a sponsee comes over to your house and he wants to know, the question he always asks at the end of a session is, what do I do? Almost all of us, if we had an issue and we went to Clancy or Tom or someone else to discuss it, at the end of that discussion, if we, you know, we might well ask that question, what do I do? The changes that we have in AA are not linear. The book and the program is transformational. The changes that we make are of God. They're spiritual. You see that new guy in the group that he comes in and he spent, you know, he's, the first couple of weeks he's talking about, you know, if he ever gets, he's going to kill his wife. He's not happy with his sobriety. He's resisting everything. And all of a sudden, somewhere in the middle of that month, something happens to him. And he's in the game, and everybody in the group can see that he's changed and he's okay. And what's happened to him is step one. He's surrendered. And he may not even see that change, but everybody else around him can see the change. A new guy will come in the group, and he doesn't want to stay, and the guy that was fighting it all the way, all of a sudden he goes over, and he's talking to the new guy, and he's a different man. Over and over in our book, we talk about, you know, when Jung is talking to Roland Hazard, and he says, you know, I don't think I can do anything for you. You go hire a bodyguard and, you know, guard yourself, and, you know, you're going to have to have a restricted life if you're ever going to have a life. He said, I've never been affected with a chronic alcoholic. And when Hazard asks him what all the drunks want to know, isn't there an exception to that? And I won't quote it exactly. I won't look it up. But he said, yeah, there's an exception to that. He said, from time to time, and he said, they're the appearance of a phenomenon. From time to time, we see people who have had this spiritual transformation where all of a sudden the fundamental ideas and beliefs of their lives are transformed. And he uses the word suddenly. And our book, over and over, uses words like suddenly, all at once. You know, they give us an idea, and many of us don't have that sense of experience today in our lives. We don't feel like all of a sudden we can, you know, that problems might change. But they do change all of a sudden. They drop away. What happens to us is that our consciousness is increased, and we start to see them in a different way. And all of a sudden we're not resisting it anymore. We're not using effort. We're not just using our information. We have gotten out of our own way. We have had a change. So the change that we need in the program, more than a change of information, is a change of heart. Not in a change of what we do, in a change of how we be. And that is what the steps do over a period of time. They change the way we be. When that changes, what you do automatically changes. Automatically changes. And that's why it is not a mechanical process. That's why you just can't. I remember when Chamberlain went to the Peachtree Conference or whatever it used to be, that Hunter or whatever his name was, you know, put on. And one time he went down there and he talked to the experts on alcoholism. Remember when he came back, someone asked him, how was the conference? And what did you think about all the experts on alcoholism? And he said, well, they don't know much about surrender. Which was kind of his way of, you know, his ability to be able to put his finger exactly on the thing. Okay. But if he could tell someone exactly how to surrender, we wouldn't have any issues. Those of us in the room, if we could on call surrender any time we really needed to, there wouldn't be any issues. But we can't. There's a way of being. There's a way of bringing yourself to the process of taking the steps. A couple of people have said, you know, have you ever seen anybody who's really taken these steps has not been able to stay sober? And I probably have to have a conversation about what we mean when we say really take the steps. But I've seen a heck of a lot of step work today and not much progress. I have seen a number of people who have gone through a process of taking a fourth and fifth step early in their sobriety, and surprisingly, they get drunk. And I don't pretend to understand it. I don't pretend to know who does. You know, we could say they haven't, you know, really done it. But I'll tell you, you know, you've got to somehow get your heart in the game, not just your head. You have to somehow bring a type of humility and honesty and openness to the process of taking the steps, or I don't think we're going to have the full benefit of the process of taking the steps. Now, sometimes you've got to go through that process when you're dry. If you're having a trouble and you get at it, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. If you wait to do it perfectly, you're going to have a hell of a long wait. You don't have to do them perfectly. It's as much a matter of attitude and where your heart is than anything else. The perfection or information or data that we have is important because our text outlines what we're supposed to do, but it is not dependent on what you know. It's dependent on how you are in the process. And if you really want to get well, if you really want to do a good third step, if you really want to do a fourth step, you know, you're going to be okay. Whatever mistakes you made in that process, you can go back and correct. You don't have to do it perfectly. You don't have to do it the way that, you know, I think people's ability to do some of these things is different from person to person. I don't think everybody can do, you know, goes through the steps in the, with the same level of interaction that everybody else does. I think some people have a very relatively simple, strong grasp. They go through the steps, they're in pretty good shape, they go to their meetings, they get about their work, and others of us are more neurotic, and we need tune-ups a little bit more often, you know, than others. But humility is a difficult thing to maintain. And what he said is the absolute death knell for humility is that of being self-directed. That we get a point in our lives where what we want becomes the highest priority of our lives. Today, one of the things that I'm taken with, when on Tuesday nights I go to a sober house with a group of guys in there, and it's always surprising to me when someone goes back out, and it's often not the guy that you think. And when the ages in those sober houses that I'm involved with, you know, range from about 20, 21 years old up to about 55 years old. And as a group, we are narcissistic, immature, spring-loaded. You know, immediate gratification is not quite quick enough. It's just fascinating today. You got guys that just, they don't have any money, and everybody's got a cell phone. I mean, they just started. I mean, it is just fascinating, and they have the new ones. You know, I mean, they have to have the. You know, the flat one, and, you know, oh, it's just extraordinary today. I mean, we are so immature that it is just scary, you know, to get to see yourself when you go see this. I mean, the level of self-centeredness is just, and sometimes we think, we wonder why. I brought another book down, and I wanted to read you the first page of this book that I sometimes read. It said, you know, one of the things I think you have to learn in long-term sobriety is not only are we not different from our fellows in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're not as different from the people out on the street as we think we are. And that would open up a lot of spiritual material for most of us. This guy said, to most of us, suffering's a fact of life. It seems inevitable despite all our attempts at consolation. The fundamental dissatisfaction of human beings has been the central concern of all religious and philosophical systems. Faced with our inability to remain happy, all the great teachers have adapted some approach to deal with that. It doesn't sound like we're the only people who have trouble staying happy. Our society today and where we live our lives, I think society the way it is today supports addiction rather than recovery. When I came in the 60s, I think society supported recovery. Today, you can sit in your room with your computer and you can order drugs over the internet, you can have sex over the internet, you can gamble over the internet. They will send you credit cards every week, you know, for $5,000. I am so glad they didn't. I know I would not have taken them, but it's just on the off chance that I might have run a few cards up. Our society is a capitalistic society, and we are a society of consumers, which is one of my big issues. If you watch a fair amount of television and you read a fair amount of magazines, you are going to be exposed to probably 1,000 messages a week that will tell you that you're not okay. Your body's not okay. Your money's not okay. Your house is not okay. Your car is not okay. They give you the message, poor baby, you're having a tough time. You shouldn't have a tough time. Life's not supposed to be difficult. You're not supposed to have problems. Take this pill. Buy this thing. Do it now. You don't have to wait. You have bad credit? Call us. No, but I mean, but the overall message is life's not supposed to be difficult, and I don't think there's anybody in this room over 50 years old that believes that. I mean, we may believe it on a given day, but I mean, no one's exempt. No one's exempt. But if that's the message, the subtle message is that you're not okay. If you have the wrong watch, the wrong sunglasses, the wrong dress, the wrong shoes, the wrong car, we're constantly getting bombarded with, you're not okay the way you are. So if you wonder sometimes why you need more than one meeting a week, you are what you fill yourself full of. And most of us, absentmindedly, are being filled with that crap that's going on in the world today. We need a place to go in and remind ourselves about who we are and what our program is. To remind ourselves, I like there's a young woman over here who's got a t-shirt, and the back of the t-shirt it says perfectly broken. I like that. There's something, you know, we're a flawed group of people. We still have the mental and spiritual aspects of the disease of alcoholism. We still need to put the principles in action in our life to maintain our spiritual condition so that we can have some of the peace and joy that we're entitled to experience in life. And we're going to get that by developing a relationship with our higher power. If you don't have a relationship with your higher power, if you're not connected, what you are related to is your intellect and your ego. You've got a 16-year-old running your life. Chamberlain talks about ego as a sense of separation. The ego is the thing that tells us that we're different. The ego is the thing that's got us in our tank, sitting down with our machine gun, looking through the slit, driving around, and that's, you know, without some focus, without some sort of centering, most of us feel about that separate, about that different. Now, when you're that separate and you're that different, not much touches us. You don't feel like you're being healed. You don't have much peace. Most of us, if you ask us what we want, we say, I just want a little happiness. For most of us, without some sort of spiritual connection, happiness is a matter of circumstances being okay. Circumstances are often not very okay in our lives. If your wife is dying of cancer, or you just got downsized at your job, or your kid just went to jail, circumstances are not okay. Being happy in that circumstance might be pretty darn difficult. But joy and peace are not conditioned upon circumstances being okay. And what we work on in Alcoholics Anonymous is maintaining a spiritual condition that I think is more connected with joy and peace, which allows us to have a place to stand that we are okay independent of what's going on around us. As Scott said, the bad news is you're the problem, the good news is you're the problem. The good news is that you can solve every issue that you have in your life by relying on a power greater than yourself. There isn't anything going on in your life. Why do we like stories like Clancy's? Why do we like stories like Tom? Why do we like John Vicar? Why do we like John Harris? Because they're like the story of Christmas. Tell it again, Daddy. Sit down, and I want to hear you tell me the story of Christmas again. I want to hear how you went to jail. I want to hear how your life was over. I want to hear how... And then at the end of it, I want you to tell me that you're okay. There were certain talks like that you just hear, and you just were okay. You walked in the room, and you were, you know, your line of credit was up to, you know, you had about 25 grand in credit card bills. You fought with your wife on the way over to the meeting. You know, your kid just got some bad grades at school, and they, you know, sent him home, and you're driving over to the meeting, and you feel like crap, and you sit down in the room, and you listen to John Vicar tell his story. And when he's telling his story, we're okay. And you know why we're okay? Because we're here. We're in the moment. We're not in the past. We're not in the future. We're here in the moment. We're not in our compulsive pattern of thinking. The way that change, I think, happens to most of us, Bill, again in step 6 and 7, talks about that we are in a headlong flight from pain, that we have spent much of our life running from pain towards what we perceive to be pleasure. And then later on in the 7th step, he talks about how that most of the fear in our life is based on the fact that we're afraid that we're going to lose something that we need or not get something that we need. That is, you know, the Buddhists call grasping. You know, that our level of desire is such that we think our happiness in our life is absolutely dependent upon certain circumstances, that we have to have those be a certain way for us to be okay. Then he suggests, as people in every major religion suggest, that the only reasonable way to find some peace in our lives, to find some relief from that pain that people talk about as being endemic in the world today, is to lower the level of our demands and desires. Now there isn't anything in the world today that would encourage us to do that. The only place that I think you get some sort of direction, and our program is based on what Sandy talks about, getting rid of self, is by taking these spiritual principles and putting them in action. And by the process of putting them in action, we start to be God-centered and other-centered. And in that process, we start to get relief from the angst that we carry around in a natural sort of way that we have when we're not connected. And that's the only place that we are going to get that kind of relief. And also, interestingly enough, when we start to get God-centered and we start to go through the process of surrender and inventorying and make a decision and doing the inventory and sharing it with another person, tearing down our walls, and then becoming entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character and humbly ask Him to remove our defects of character, we start to get an experience that it's okay, absolutely independent of whatever's going on outside of ourselves. I mean, we're in meetings all the time with people that have cancer. We're in meetings all the time with people who have lost children and lost wives. Many of those people are in better shape than we're in. And being in a room like that helps you, just being in the presence of someone who's got that kind of courage and who's that plugged in the program. We do that for each other. We have a collective consciousness in this room that when someone comes in and it isn't okay, for some reason in this room, it is okay. And often when you go to leave the room, it's still okay because you start to take some of that with you. When it isn't okay is when we go back in that little cocoon in our head and that internal dialogue. Okay? So the only true freedom that I think I get in the program today is freedom from my thinking. I never used to have that. I used to have a thought, and I'd glue it on my eyeball. And when you take a thought and it's glued on your eyeball, it's all there is. It is your reality. There is no other sense of it not being. It just seems like, I have a thought, I'm going to act on it. Little by little, over a time in the program, I started to be able to experience a gap between my thinking and my reaction. I used to be a monkey on a string, thought, reaction, thought, reaction, thought, reaction. But you have helped me realize that there's a gap between that. So today, when I get a thought, I do not have to glue it on my eyeball. I can hold it out here. Frank Milo, a buddy of mine, used to talk about Grand Central Station mind. You don't have to get on every train that goes through the station. You can actually let a few go through, and kind of watch them. Can you imagine the freedom in that, to not have to engage every goofy thought that goes through our mind? We think we initiate our thinking. I mean, if you truly think you initiate your thinking, try meditating. Try stopping it. When you sit down to stop it, you for the first time, you see two things. Number one, you don't generate it. It generates itself. You can't shut it off. So you're not the generator of your thoughts. Number two, you can watch your thoughts. So when most people who are experts in meditation, they talk about, kind of sinking down to the bottom of the river, grabbing the weeds and let the boats go by. Because they'll just change. So it isn't a matter of stopping your thinking, it's a matter of not engaging it so much. And that's what I think as our minds quiet down. We don't have the frantic mind of the newcomer. We aren't in a drama. We aren't in our opera at every moment in time. And when you start to experience that, you start to experience some peace and some quiet, which is a relief. Because most of us, when Bill talks about the fact that we're so engaged in having to get what we want and not lose what we have, that he said that we've only, you know, most of us are only, have, you know, our mental experience is one of excitement or depression. You know, we don't have much peace as in our mental state of mind. So we have to start to get some freedom from that, and the freedom from that comes, I think, very substantially when we start to do 4 and 5 and 6 and 7, and 8, you know, when we start to do the block of work between the third step and the tenth step. And that when the promises come, and different people use different words, some of the people who say, you know, well, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through, and some people would say before you're halfway through steps 4 through 10, you will be amazed before you're halfway through. So somewhere early on in that process, you will start to experience a sense of well-being that we have. And when you don't have that experience of well-being, what you are involved with is just your own internal dialogue. And it'll screw you into the ground. You know, it just absolutely will. The internal dialogue that is going on is the dialogue of the ego. It is a dialogue that tells you that you're different, that you're unique, that you're not okay. It is the person who compares himself when Scott's talking this morning. There's no comfort in that. I was comparing it, you know, he knows more than I do. I don't like that. Or he's a good, no, but I mean, my ego, if I do that, I mean, that's what it's doing. That's the dialogue that's going through my head. And, you know, there is no comfort in that. There is no peace in that. There's also no humility in that. The humility of it, you know, if I'm in a pretty good place and I'm reasonably humble, you can just enjoy how well someone does something. You do not have to compare yourself to that person. You can literally, thoroughly, you know, enjoy what Charlie did. And I can just take a look at that, and I don't have to worry about whether I could be as funny as Charlie or as insightful as Charlie. I can just enjoy what he did. And it's just, I can just be with what's there without adding my interpretation of it, which is why we have trouble attending to life on life's terms. We are never in life on life's terms. We have an experience, and then we do an interpretation of the experience. And that's our reality. We start to experience what we thought someone said to us and why they said it and what they meant by it. And we start to build a drama around the thing rather than just be there with whatever the heck it was. We have trouble doing that. But over a period of time, when you empty out, you know, when you do your fourth and fifth step and tear down your wall and you start to have a sense of belonging and you start to commit yourself that you really are open to having those things change in your life and that God is going to cast those things out, the way they are cast out is the process of the 12 steps. At the end of the 12th step, it talks about us being more awake. And what happens when you're more awake is you start to see things in your life as they really are. If we ever really got really awake, we would start to see ourselves as others see us. That is one of the highest levels of skills that we would have. Because couldn't we sit around with the people who are in our group and do a pretty good job of doing their inventory? We don't do that good a job on our own. Okay, but we have a pretty good sense. Well, I want you to know that they could do a pretty good job on you. Okay, that they have a pretty good sense of what works and doesn't work in our lives. And I think what my program means for me today is that I'm in the game. I really am trying to practice the principles in all my affairs. I'm trying to, you know, do a better job with the arenas of my life, whether it's my relationship with Linda, who's pretty difficult, and oh, she's nice in public. I mean, there is, I mean, it is, you know. I don't like traveling with Linda. People like her better than me, and it just makes it hard. No, but maintaining relationships is tough. And you have to have some humility. You have to have an idea, why not you? You know, you're not exempt. Life's not supposed to be problem-free. What we're given is a strength and a program and a set of principles that allows us put them in action in our lives, and the result of putting them in action in our lives, we see life in a different way. And it is extraordinary. It is, it's just almost miraculous. Thank you for having me here this weekend.